Sorry, not believing in the velaya of an imam, is it itself a deviation? Imam will act against that or not?
Deviation has different forms and different, actually, perspectives. But this can be included as one. But one important point should be in our minds that imam is not going to be the imam of Shi'as at the time that he's going to come and start his revolution. He is imam of all the inhabitants of the earth. You see, I mean, then, for example, no Shia can say, okay, he is our imam and we are waiting only for this to come. Yes. No, when people hear the message, so then they will be waiting for a savior that comes and talks through their hearts, you see. Tells them something which is very close to their internal feelings. And their fitra, their nature.
Right. Okay, in a nature,
see?
That's right.
So it's true that there was a deviation from the concept of velaya.
Yes.
And maybe all of these catastrophes that we are afflicted with is due to this our foreignness and being distant from velaya.
Yes.
But humanity has been suffering.
The concept of tawhid of Allah subhanahu
has been suffering in the course of history.
Yes.
So because velaya is a means towards the tawhid. Mm-hmm. Then all these things are needed to be corrected, and but this is not something that we can focus on to say that anyone who is against wala is not going to join imam. We have even in hadith that some of the unbelievers come and join in the army of imam, as we had the experience of it in the event of Ashura.
Yes.
That some of
you
even
mean by
Christians,
unbelievers,
even a person who was a Christian turned to be Muslim, not again to be a Shia, to be a real follower of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and became a companion of Imam.
Okay,
right.
That's right.
We should actually have this mentality corrected in our in our mindset.
There's a lot to say again about the deviation. What are they exactly, and what do you mean exactly? But as you said, Imam As is going to address humanity per se. I mean, for the sake of humanity itself, regardless of the color, religion, language, or something like that, the fitra of the people all across the world, the truth seekers, is addressed by Imam As and his companions. Inshallah, we are among such people too. Thank you much, Brother Alavian.
You're welcome.
For a nice elaboration regarding this topic. We have to elaborate more on this topic on the upcoming session of the program, The Last Savior. Thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of The Last Savior. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Tonight on Exposé, Western Broadcast Media's narrative of the March 1st parliamentary elections in the Islamic Republic of Iran revolved around made-up stories about Iranians abstained from voting in protest against their government. Meanwhile, the majority of opinion pieces written by prominent Western mainstream media refuse to accept that Iran is a democratic state, bringing nothing new to their reporting tone and essentially rehashing old tales and narratives. And the famine brought on by the ongoing Zionist Israeli genocide in Gaza, as well as the airdrop charade of aid and expired food on Gaza residents, was another hot topic last week, particularly on social media. Welcome to Exposé, the show that leaves no stone unturned. Hundreds of headlines preceding and following the parliamentary elections in Iran were portrayed on major Western news outlets, but irony rested in relying on the opinion of just one or two citizens to adopt broad front-page headlines talking about the absence of democracy in Iran. Let us hear from Fuad Itayim, our broadcast expert and writer at The Cradle, more about it in Fake News Exposé. The electoral battle for the new parliament and the assembly of experts in Iran, which took place at the beginning of March, revolved around the younger generation of conservatives who succeeded in tipping the scales in many electoral districts, a fact that did not go down well with Western media. Here is more about this with our broadcast expert, Fuad Itayim. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having
Fuad, to talk about this. What do you have for us about this?
So Western broadcast media has addressed the 2024 parliamentary elections in Iran. And the main message that was propagated by most of these outlets was that somehow the Iranian people stayed away from the ballot in protest against the government.
Okay.
So let's start with the British media outlet Channel 4, who sent its lead presenter, Krishnan Guru Murthy, to cover the news of the 2024 elections in Iran. Mm-hmm. And he decided to basically not focus at all on the issue of the election and resort back to the same old Western media narrative that mm-hmm. rights are crushed in Iran.
Welcome to Tehran. In 2 days' time, Iranians will vote to renew their parliament in a key test for the country's regime. The test being how many people will show up to the polls, but not necessarily who will win. They are the first elections since mass protests broke out 2 years ago following the death of a young woman, Mahsa Amini, under suspicious circumstances after she was arrested for not wearing a hijab.
So Krishnan decides to open with the story of the late young Mahsa Amini, who mm-hmm. died in September 2022. And according to coronary examinations after her death, Mahsa Amini died from cerebral hypoxia, mm-hmm. basically disproving the claims that she was killed by security forces. Despite this fact, he maintains that she died under suspicious circumstances. Typical Western propaganda.
And he opens with it about a feature report about Iranian elections. So this has nothing even to do with the protests that
exactly.
happened years ago.
So making it worse, Krishnan then finds a young non-hijabi woman on mm-hmm. the streets of Tehran, mm-hmm. hoping that she's going to tell him that the police have been harassing her, beating her, threatening her. And the answer he gets is disappointing.
Do you mind me asking, I mean, you're not covering your head. Do you feel worried about being out when you're not covered?
No. Nobody's ever given me any trouble. No one has.
Is that normal in Tehran? Everywhere in Tehran? Or is it just here?
No. I haven't had trouble anywhere.
I don't think he liked what she said, did he?
Not so much. He seems quite unsatisfied with the answer. So what he does now is he moves on to a group of other ladies who they say oppose the policies of the Iranian government. Mm-hmm. Instead of taking advantage of the situation and asking them in more detail why they're opposed to the government, why they'd like to sit out the current election, mm-hmm. He decides to ask them about the genocide in Gaza.
The other thing we're asking people about is the situation in Gaza. So do you think the people feel the same way as the government when it comes to regional politics?
No. Are you kidding with me? Iranian people like peace. Yes. They want to live in peace. Yeah. If you look at our history, all of the time they wanted to be in peace. But the government is the opposite of that.
I don't know how this relates to the Iranian election, which were, by the way, won in majority by the conservative side. Mm-hmm. But it seems that Krishnan failed to find what he was looking for on the streets of Tehran, which was widespread anti-government sentiment. That seems to be what he thinks he's going to find. So he decides to ask about the situation in Gaza and resorts to the idea that Iranians don't care about the Palestinian struggle and only want peace. So his question is about Gaza. So what peace exactly is he referring to? Mm-hmm. Peace with Israel, the illegal occupying state whose flag is painted on the streets of
Tehran. Basically, people just stomp on while walking. We're talking about the same state that has openly supported resistance against Zionist Israel for the past at least four decades. So I think that question was some sort of a question that he wanted to get out of the people's minds, where they do not support any resistance in the region. But I mean,
100%. And he's asking a few people on the street
exactly,
instead of carrying out
exactly.
a widespread survey.
It's while obvious. Talking about an election that the opposition lost.
Exactly. 100%. So another mainstream outlet that propagated fake news and lies was CBS News.
So no surprise there whatsoever.
Definitely not. So CBS News got a hold of Karim Sajjadpour, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Now, Karim, an American-born Iranian who studied at Johns Hopkins and resides in the United States, here makes sure to spew as much hatred as possible against the Islamic Republic without any facts to back up his claims. Let's hear what he had to say.
It's good to see you again. This was the first parliamentary election in Iran since the sustained mass protests over the death of Mahsa Amini. Does the turnout tell you anything?
It's another reminder, John, that Iranians know they're living under a religious dictatorship that can't be reformed via the ballot box. I think what's particularly insulting for Iranians is that, you know, all politicians lie everywhere, but when you're being ruled by a religious government that rules from a moral pedestal and engages in this level of corruption and repression, I think it's even more insulting than just being ruled by a run-of-the-mill corrupt dictatorship.
We have enough trouble believing polls here in the United States, so I hesitate to put so much or read too much into those opinions expressed in that poll. But do the findings square with your understanding about public sentiment in the greater population of Iran?
Definitely. I think everyone who has been following Iran for a while or has visited the country has noted these popular sentiments for many years now, that, you know, after 4.5 decades of living under religious government, people want to separate mosque and state.
So it's quite audacious claiming that people live in a religious dictatorship in Iran and that the people somehow want to separate mosque and state, even though the entire country revolted against an actual dictatorship in 1979, a dictatorship that was secular and backed by America and Israel and suppressed the rights of the entire population. Also, none of the figures that he's using are based on any of the recent election results.
And I don't know where he's getting the facts from. I mean, these analysts that go on Western media, especially broadcast media, who are supposedly American-born Iranians, but either have never visited Iran or they visit Iran to see family and then return. They don't even conduct any kind of surveys or try to get data from the people, from the public. The least that they could do, ask the communities that they visit and then go on TV and say things like this, claiming that if you are a religious state, then you are a dictatorship. I mean, that literally applies to 70% of the states around the world, and that still is not the fact, not the real story about Iran. But anyways, I want to thank you very much, Fuad, for explaining to us how the broadcast media was basically spewing all these lies about the elections in Iran. Now, ladies and gents, we move on to digital mainstream media. It wasn't easy for Western mainstream media to accept a contrasting scene to what they had been promoting in the days leading up to the parliamentary elections in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Most of the opinion pieces published by major Western news outlets were struck by the public choice in Iran that they practically recycled the same old stories and repeated the same old narrative when it comes to their regime's disapproval of democracy in Iran. Julia Qasim, our mainstream media expert, joins us to tell us more about it. The floor is all yours, Julia.
Thanks, Marwa. So despite the massive Western campaign to against Iran to basically boycott the elections for the Islamic Consultative Assembly and the Assembly of Experts, citizens participated enthusiastically with noticeable lines at the polling stations continuing on until the very last moments of the 1st of March. So, however, the New York Times continued to spread lies by claiming that many ordinary Iranians were fed up with a faltering economy and the so-called government's oppressive rules and violent crackdowns on peaceful protests, instead of reporting the reality on the real reasons behind the economic hardships inside Iran, represented by the aggressive U.S. and EU sanctions illegally imposed on the Iranian people. So, in a piece published on March 1st, 2024, written by Farnaz Farsikhi and Leili Nirokazar, entitled "Many Iranians Boycott Vote Despite Officials' Pleas and Roses at Polls," the New York Times claimed that the residents across a range of locations, big cities like Tehran, Isfahan, and Shiraz, and smaller ones like Sari and Lahijan, said in interviews that polling stations in their neighborhoods were mostly empty and only the most loyal supporters of the government had shown up to vote. with many other Iranians choosing not to even leave their homes. Mm-hmm. But in reality, Marwa, a small search on the same cities mentioned in this article, and you can see that they lied about the turnout, especially in the capital Tehran and Shiraz and Isfahan. So the New York Times piece was less chaotic than the foreign policy one published on February 29, 2024, just one day before Election Day. The first suspicious part of this piece, writers themselves, where we have no evidence whatsoever if they were even Iranian or not.
Wow.
As the foreign policy claims they were, Saki Nasiri, a pseudonym of a journalist in Iran, and Tuba Moshiri, another pseudonym of a journalist in Iran, who wrote an article titled Iran's New, Even Worse Hijab Era Has Begun.
Wow.
So the foreign policy here falsely claims that freedoms are increasingly under threat for Iran's female citizens, according to women's rights advocates and United Nations experts, who say that the hijab crackdown is creating a chilling effect on women's rights activism and legitimizing broader gender discrimination. Mind you, these women's rights advocates and UN experts have no names and no positions, which puts such claims at the level of heresy. Mm-hmm. This piece by Foreign Policy continues to spread lies, claiming that Iranian women now cannot drive, cannot do their jobs, and can't even have coffee without worrying about having their cars impounded, being fired, or getting hit with fines if the hijab is not worn or worn too loosely. Yet in reality, if you go on YouTube and research these claims, look at the malls in Tehran, look at the streets of Tehran, you can instantly see that these statements are completely false and they're nothing but fake news.
I've been there. I've seen it firsthand. It is completely fake news. And as you said, people can just surf the internet and see what Tehran and other cities in Iran look like.
Yeah, I've been there twice too. And in the north of Tehran, women are wearing hats instead of, and nobody's, you know, impounding them. Police is right there and nothing's going on. So you don't even need to really ask people. Just do a little bit of research on your own outside of these obviously biased sources.
Definitely.
So lastly, the foreign policy piece claims that Iran is regularly ranked as one of the worst countries to be a woman in terms of gender parity for economic opportunities, education, health concerns, and political leadership. Guess according to whom, Marwa? According to research by the World Bank and the World Economic Forum, WEF. So that was coming from an American news publication, the same America that does not only suppress women, but now has given the right for men to identify as women while knowing fully well that education and health care are completely free for all Iranian citizens, unlike the USA, where they wrote these dishonest lines about Iranian woman.
Wow. I mean, the audacity, especially of these organizations who continue to control many sovereign states but have never been able to control the Iranian state, for that matter, claim that all these fake news about Iran just to play with words and brainwash the public. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, and they want to begin with their current control of Iran by controlling women, which they haven't been able to do.
Despite the fact that women in Iran have their rights met years ago, some rights that are not even found in the West. But I want to thank you very much, our mainstream media expert in this segment, Ms. Julia Qasim, for joining us to talk about this pressing matter that we always see whenever there's something happening in Iran, especially if it's elections. Thank you for your contribution, dear Julia. And now, ladies and gents, we move on to social media expose. Another topic that was center stage last week, especially on social media platforms, was the airdrop charade of aid and expired food on Gaza residents and the famine caused by the ongoing Zionist-Israeli genocide. Here is Sima Itaim, our social media expert and editor at The Cradle, with more.
Thank you, Marwa. So airdropping aid, much like a placebo, it might make people feel better if they're watching, people who are watching from afar. But at the end of the day, it's a showy PR exercise and it's inadequate. It's pathetically inadequate.
I hear you.
It's useless to the point where it becomes a metaphor and not more for the abject failure of the international community to muster up any kind of meaningful response to such an immense, unprecedented humanitarian tragedy.
I second that. Definitely.
So for the first post, we have a post by Big Brother 7 who criticizes these airdrops, saying, reports from Gaza say the airdrops of today weren't enough for 100 people. For reference, there are hundreds of thousands of starving people in northern Gaza, with many children already dying due to hunger. The airdrops are just a cruel charade at this point.
I second his opinion. I mean, people who see my Twitter can see that I was very vocal about this, so I'm not going to stop you anymore.
Right. We knew. I mean, we could tell from the beginning. And then the aid killed some civilians.
Yes, exactly.
So, it got even worse than what we had expected. Mm-hmm. For the second post, we have by Quds News Network that mm-hmm. quotes the Gaza government media office reporting that the situation of famine is deteriorating, with 2.4 million people experiencing severe food shortages and airdrops, which have proven to be futile.
No, my God.
So along with this post, Quds News Network attaches a photo with a quotation from the Gaza government media office saying that dropping aid from the air and avoiding its entry through the crossings circumvents the root solutions to the problem.
Definitely. I mean, the border is there. Open the border, for the love of God.
Where there are thousands of trucks, not mm-hmm. just hundreds, waiting Definitely. To be let through.
Mm-hmm.
We have another post by Assaf, MD, on X, mm-hmm. saying that not only is the amount of aid being airdropped completely insufficient, the most vulnerable of Gaza's civilian population will be unable to access the aid.
Mm-hmm.
So he attached a video where a CARE representative in Ramallah tells Sky News that these airdrops make it impossible for people with disabilities to remain alive.
First of all, there is the issue of accuracy, there is the issue of being so expensive, the limited number that they will have, and the limited content. So it's only meals, while the needs are massive. And most importantly, you only those who can reach physically strong to reach to these aid will be getting them. So women, elderly, women-headed household, people with, unfortunately, disabilities will not be among those that are going to access the aid.
So even people with disabilities are finding it hard to get the least amount of aid in Gaza.
Yeah, the minimum. We have another post on X from a Gaza resident who is currently displaced to southern Gaza with his family, Maisara at whatever 2067, laying it out as it is. Jordan complicity turns Gaza into a hunger game where people have to fight and even get killed to get food. Israel wanted this and Jordan airdrops did the job.
Sadly said by a Gazan who is a resident of Gaza displaced to Rafah. And I think the people that we should hear the most are the Palestinian people in Gaza and no one else outside that besieged area.
Mm-hmm. So now in response to the World Health Organization's report entitled Gaza Worst Famine Fears Realized as 10th Child Reportedly Starves to Death,
mm-hmm.
Michael Fakhri, who is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, posted, Israel has been intentionally starving the Palestinian people in Gaza since October 8. Now famine may very well be already occurring. The only way to prevent this famine is an immediate ceasefire. And the only way to get a ceasefire is to sanction Israel. Wow. So that was a first, mm-hmm. I think, Marwa. We see a UN rapporteur calling for sanctioning the Israeli entity.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've seen that before.
Mm-hmm.
In order to reach a ceasefire, this is kind of coming to terms with reality, finally realizing that there is no other way around this.
Definitely. Even we were listening a bit from the Biden administration, certain officials saying that they don't condone what's happening, yet they don't have the power to change it, which we really don't believe. But listening to this, having this voice out in the open, especially on social media, is something unprecedented indeed, and all for the sake of Palestinians in Gaza. Thank you very much, Seema, for
Thank
your
you,
contribution
Mara.
And telling us what happened on X, especially on X this time, because it was a very heated discussion concerning whether aid was actually helping the Palestinians or not. Thank you for being here and for your analysis. Now, ladies and gents, we move on to Figures Exposé. The overwhelming majority of civilians in Gaza are dependent on direct assistance from the UNRWA agency, which is also a critical lifeline for other aid organizations working inside Gaza that rely on its aid infrastructure to distribute support. However, a recent opinion poll shows that the majority of the Israeli entity settlers oppose the transfer of humanitarian aid to Palestinian people in the besieged Gaza Strip, where the occupying regime has been waging a genocidal war since October 2023. The findings were published in a survey conducted by the so-called Israel Democracy Institute, saying over two out of the three Jewish Israeli settlers, which accounted for 68% of respondents, disapprove of the transfer of humanitarian aid to Gaza residents at this time, while a large 85% majority of Arab respondents in occupied Palestine supported. Now, when asked, Do you support or oppose the idea that Zionist Israel should allow the transfer of humanitarian aid to Gaza residents at this time, with food and medicine being transferred by international bodies that are not linked to Hamas or to the UNRWA? Arab respondents gave an 85% approval to 13% disapproval rate. Left Jews gave a 59% approval to 39% approval rate. Disapproval rate. Now, center Jews gave a 44% approval to 51.5% disapproval rate. And right-wing Jews gave a 19% approval to a swooping 80% disapproval rate. Now, the results of the Israeli entity survey came as the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, said in a recent report that 550,000 people in Gaza are currently facing catastrophic food insecurity levels. Now, let us move on to the most notable expose voices for this week. Imagine you are at home with your wife and children. It's dinner time before you put your three children to sleep. The room is cold, the propane cooking cylinder is empty, and there is no food, no electricity, and no drinking water. This is Gaza. Gaza is starving. Starvation in Gaza is not due to a drought or natural disaster, but it is rather an Israeli entity-made catastrophe enabled by the U.S. Biden administration. Rana Umeish on Instagram shared a video by a Palestinian displaced resident of Gaza who wept while telling us about the last meal he had. For famine to be declared, at least 20% of the population must be suffering extreme food shortages, with one in three children acutely malnourished and two people out of every 10,000 dying daily from starvation or from malnutrition and disease. But in late December, the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, IPC, said that the situation in Gaza has already exceeded the 20% threshold. Now, as the United States airdropped aid into the Gaza Strip, its parachutes, like those of the other participating countries, brought only a tiny fraction of the aid needed for the 2.2 million Palestinians trapped without food, water, or medical supplies. However, never in a million years would have anyone thought that the U.S. dropped food aid would be expired food. Yes, you heard that right. Let's hear Bobby's voice on TikTok.
38,000 expired meals. The Biden administration just dropped 38,000 expired meals into Gaza. I quite literally don't even know what to say about this. Like, to be that vile and foul of a human being, if you can even call yourself that, to send people who are actively starving to death food that is actively dangerous, that is expired, that could poison them. You are not only, you're not being complicit in genocide. At that point, you are actively taking part in it.
Indeed, they are. Now, ladies and gents, with that, we conclude our expose for tonight. Stay tuned for more eye-opening investigations on Expose. The truth is just a revelation away.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, senior Tories have rallied around Prime Minister Rishi Sunak amid claims that some Conservative MPs are plotting to replace him with Penny Mordaunt. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Press Association news agency PA Media has covered this story, and tells us more. Senior Tories have sought to downplay reports that some Conservative MPs are plotting to replace Rishi Sunak as Prime Minister with Penny Mordaunt before the general election. A source close to the House of Commons leader, Ms. Mordaunt, rejected claims of an organised attempt to elevate her to the Tory leadership as nonsense. Conservative former minister Dame Andrea Jenkins, who has publicly backed installing a new leader before the nation goes to the polls, denied that right-wing Conservative MPs were coalescing around Penny Mordaunt. Sir Jacob Rees-Mogg, a former business secretary, denounced the idea as madness. With many Tories increasingly concerned about losing their seats at the next general election, reports in the Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph suggest MPs on the right of the Conservative Party met moderates this week to discuss uniting behind Penny Mordaunt if the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak faces a no-confidence vote. It followed a difficult week for Rishi Sunak, in which he came under fire over his handling of racist comments allegedly made by a major Conservative Party donor, and the defection of Lee Anderson, who Mr. Sunak had promoted to Tory deputy chairman, to the right-wing populist Reform UK party. Penny Mordaunt, who was a contender in the party's leadership race to replace Boris Johnson in 2022, has not commented on the claims, but allies suggested she was focusing on her ministerial role. Dame Andrea Jenkins tweeted, "Interesting to hear lots of media reporting on centre-right Conservative MPs pushing for a certain leadership candidate to replace Rishi Sunak. Having spoken with lots of my colleagues, no one seems to have heard or been pushing for such a thing." Noise about Rishi Sunak's position grew louder in Westminster this week after Jeremy Hunt's budget failed to boost the Tories' dire polling figures and No. 10 Downing Street's struggled to deal with the fallout from Frank Hester's remarks about MP Diane Abbott, which Rishi Sunak eventually condemned as racist after 24 hours of prevarication. While refusing to return the £10 million the businessman Frank Hester has donated to the Tory party. But a No. 10 Downing Street source said the Prime Minister is focused on delivering on his plan to build a brighter Britain. The plan is starting to work with inflation down, mortgages down, wages up, the economy forecast to grow and the boats down by a third. But there's more to be done, that's what the Prime Minister is concentrating on. In contrast, Labour leader Keir Starmer has no plan and would take us back to square one. The febrile mood within Rishi Sunak's ranks came as he ruled out holding a general election on 2nd of May to coincide with local elections, having previously indicated he will send the country to the polls in the later half of 2024. A growing list of Conservative MPs have announced their exit from Parliament, with Armed Forces Minister James Hippie, ex-party chairman Sir Brandon Lewis, and former Prime Minister Theresa May, some of the most recent additions. More than 60 Conservative MPs have so far said they do not plan to run, prompting Sir Ed Davey to accuse many of running away from the Liberal Democrats because they know that we can beat them in those seats. Speaking to the Press Association news agency ahead of his party's spring conference in York, the Liberal Democratic leader expressed optimism about nabbing Conservative constituencies across the southwest of England and across the whole Blue Wall, where it's a Liberal Democrat-Conservative fight. Sir Ed Davey said, "The response we're getting is phenomenal. Lifeline Conservatives switching to the Liberal Democrats, which gives us great, great belief that we can beat many Conservative MPs whenever the election comes." The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. Senior Tories attempted to rally behind an increasingly beleaguered Rishi Sunak on Saturday night, 16th of March, amid claims that some Conservative MPs are plotting to replace him with Penny Mordaunt before the next general election. Former Cabinet Ministers Jacob Rees-Mogg and David Davis went public to denounce the idea as madness and bonkers, as did senior backbenchers including former Vice-Chair of the 1922 Committee, Sir Charles Walker. With many backbench Tories, including some with healthy majorities, increasingly fearful of losing their seats in an election wipeout, accounts of a plot to oust Rishi Sunak surfaced on Saturday in the Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph. The Daily Mail said MPs on the right of the Conservative Party had held talks with moderates about uniting behind Penny Mordaunt, the leader of the House of Commons, and anointing her as leader in a coronation in the coming weeks. Penny Mordaunt made no public comment about the claims, but her supporters said she was not party to or aware of any such plot, and that she believed the stories were an attempt by her detractors on the right to damage any potential challenge she may make in the future after a Tory election defeat. Several Tory MPs maintain, however, that Penny Mordaunt has been on manoeuvres for months, making clear she would be happy to visit MPs' constituencies and get to know their local party officials. David Davis, who is close to Penny Mordaunt and backed her campaign against Liz Truss in 2022, said the idea was completely bonkers at all levels and would mean calls for an election would become irresistible. "We need to fight this election together, and we won't do it if we're fighting each other," David Davis said. "Whoever won such a contest would be the shortest-serving Prime Minister ever, even shorter than Liz Truss." Jacob Rees-Mogg said any attempt to hold yet another contest would backfire. "Whom the gods would destroy, they first make mad. The idea that changing the Prime Minister now would make the Conservatives more popular with an election in view is madness. It will be destructive for the Tories." Sir Charles Walker insisted a majority of Tories would ensure another contest or coronation did not take place. "It is beyond belief that sensible people in the Conservative Parliamentary Party would allow a leadership contest to happen," he said. "It will not be allowed. It is about a faction of the Conservative Party that thrives on drama and chaos." Several senior figures argued that far from being a unifying figure, Penny Mordaunt would actually be hugely divisive herself. They said her views on Israel, on gender and various other issues would mean most of the right would never support her.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawbid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
My pleasure. Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
You're welcome. We are still actually in the month of Ramadan, this blessed month of God, in which we try to, in fact, touch on some of the jurisprudential laws related to fasting and the month of Ramadan. according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Let me start this episode with this question, Sheikh. A pregnant woman does not know whether fasting will harm her baby or not. Does she still have to fast?
Well, if she has reasonable grounds to fear that fasting would harm her baby, then it's not obligatory to fast. And if there's no such ground, there's no likelihood or fear that it might cause any damage to the baby or to the mother's health, which ultimately will have bearing on the child's health, then of course she must observe fast. Because I've seen many women who are very strong, very sturdy, and very healthy. Mm-hmm. Fasting does not affect their health. Right. And so they have to fast. It's not, when there's genuine fear that it might damage the mother's health and as a result the child's health, mm-hmm. of course, she does not have to fast.
I see. A pregnant woman fasted, Sheikh.
Yeah.
When she delivered, the baby was found dead. It means that there was a miscarriage.
Yes.
From the beginning, she had thought that her fasting might be harmful, but she fasted nevertheless. Well, my questions are as follows. Was her fasting valid, first of all? And two, is she liable to pay blood money? Three, what is the ruling in her case if she didn't think that fasting would be harmful, but later found it to be true otherwise?
Hmm. Well, if she fasted even after she had reasonable fears that fasting would be harmful and injurious to her health or that of the baby, or she discovered later that fasting was harmful to herself or her baby, of course, then her fast is invalid and she has to perform in its qaza, of course. But the liability of paying the blood money depends upon proving that her fasting caused the death of the fetus. You know, if it is established that it was because of the mother fasting that the fetus actually was terminated, it was destroyed, or it resulted in the death of the fetus, then she becomes liable for the blood money. Otherwise, she will not.
Mm-hmm. And what about the other questions?
The last question was very much similar to the first question, actually.
Uh-huh. I see. Okay. Somebody asked, a lady, upon delivery, God Almighty blessed me with a son who's being breastfed. The blessed month of Ramadan is approaching, and at present, I'm capable of fasting. However, if I fast, my milk will yes. dry up, and as I have a, weak constitution, and my baby wants milk every 10 minutes. What should I do?
Hmm. Well, if there is fear, genuine fear, of harm to your baby due to a reduction caused by fasting. The reduction in the quantity of milk, of course, or maybe fasting might result in drying up the milk. The milk will get dried up. So in this case, she has to break the fast because it's necessary for the mother to take care of not only herself but also the child.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, of course, the mother has to give 750 grams of food as fidya. Because of not fasting and because of suckling the child and breastfeeding the child, she has to give 750 grams of foodstuff to the poor Shia Muslims. And also, she must observe the qadha after the month of Ramadan.
I see. Okay. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, after the break. Stay with us.
Ya Allah, thank you for another chance standing at my door. Ya Allah, you've given me hope, delivered this gift right to my home. Marhab, marhab, ya Ramadan, ahi qulubana bil
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad Hossein, this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting with Sheikh Javed. Sheikh, some physicians who are not truly committed to the Islamic laws or might not be aware of them, basically, forbid their patients to fast, claiming that fasting is detrimental to their health. Should their orders be acted on or what?
Well, you know, if the physician is not trustworthy, his statements do not, in the sense that his statements do not bring any confidence to the person who refers to him, and of course, he cannot, his words cannot be taken for granted. It means that whatever he says, that the patient should actually look at himself or herself to see whether he can fast or not. And she has, or maybe he has enough experience. Maybe the doctor tells him, you shouldn't fast, because many doctors in this time around actually want to suggest to their patients, to their clients, okay, don't fast because fasting is going to hurt you, it is going to harm you because you will get dehydrated and so on and so forth. Of course, if he is trustworthy, if he's sincere in his advice, then he can, and there's also a kind of fear that actually is there with the patient. He has to go ahead and break his fast. But if he is not, if he by way of experience, he understands that, okay, he can fast and fasting will not be harmful. I have seen many people who are suffering from diabetes. And yes, you see, in the month of Ramadan, they say they are in a better condition than they used to be, because they don't, you know, eat a lot of sweets or maybe sugary things. So finally, at the end of the month, they are doing much better than they used to be, actually.
But you know that those people who are suffering from diabetes should actually hydrate themselves with a lot of water. They have to drink a lot. So if they can't drink, especially in those areas where fasting becomes too long, like the days are too long in the summer, for example. Yeah.
But in this time around, you know, there's a hadith from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his family. He said, "Sumu tasihu." Mm-hmm. Okay, you should fast and you will be healthy. If we trust this saying of the Prophet, then and we observe fast, of believing course, that fasting will have its positive effect on us.
But if they are sick already, if they are ill.
Yeah, that's another thing.
That's
again,
another thing.
There's if you and are, it is, if your health is going to deteriorate, okay,
right,
and get worsened, then you understand it yourself.
Exactly.
Your personal experience shows whether you are going, you're doing better or not.
Sheikh, regarding the question that I asked you,
yes,
is being committed to Islamic laws necessary for the doctor's orders and prescription to be taken seriously by the patients, like for not to
it
fast?
It is not.
Uh-huh, I see. Not. Their only medical profession is important, right?
Yeah.
So if they know something, they know what they're doing.
Yeah, that's why His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that if his advice brings confidence, and it's a kind of reassuring to you, gives you enough confidence that, okay, fasting may be somehow negative. Mm-hmm. It may prove to be
harmful for the condition,
then you should stop fasting.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Mahajad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting with Sheikh Javed. Sheikh Javed, somebody asked, my mother was ill for a period of almost 13 years and couldn't fast. I know for certain that what prevented her from this duty was her need to take medicine.
Yes.
Please enlighten us if it is obligatory for her to perform the qadha of these missed fasts.
Someone who is persistently and continuously sick and remains sick is not supposed to fast. And of course, fasting is harmful for such a person. And because fasting is going to endanger his or her health. Now, when it comes to this mother, as you gave the example of a woman who could not fast for 13 years, of course, if she remained ill throughout the following year, the ensuing year, the year after the month of Ramadan, until the next Ramadan, there's no...
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jahad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
My pleasure. Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
You're welcome. We are still actually in the month of Ramadan, this blessed month of God. In which we try to, in fact, touch on some of the jurisprudential laws related to fasting and the month of Ramadan, according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Let me start this episode with this question, Sheikh. A pregnant woman does not know whether fasting will harm her baby or not. Does she still have to fast?
Well, if she has reasonable grounds to fear that fasting would harm her baby, then it's not obligatory to fast. And if there's no such ground, there's no likelihood or fear that it might cause any damage to the baby or to the mother's health, which ultimately will have bearing on the child's health, then, of course, she must observe fast, because I've seen many women who are very strong, very sturdy, and very healthy. Mm-hmm. Fasting does not affect their health, and so they have to fast. It's not when there is genuine fear that it might damage the mother's health and as a result the child's health. Mm-hmm. Of course, she does not have to fast.
I see. A pregnant woman fasted, Sheikh.
Yeah.
When she delivered, the baby was found dead. Means that there was a miscarriage.
Yes.
From the beginning, she had thought that her fasting might be harmful, but she fasted nevertheless.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.